Philip Tarlow, we are talking because you have a show at the Launchpad, Carbondale Arts. It's called Motion. Let's start with why you call it Motion.
All righty. Well, if you've ever been next to a creek or a stream, or especially in this area where we live, which is our altitude is about 8,000, 8,500 feet. And right above us are 14,000-foot peaks. And in the spring, but all year round, basically, the water comes rushing down those creeks and creates a lot of motion. And I have been going to the creek painting outdoors, which is called plein air, which after the French means open air, you know, plein air painting, for, you know, as long as we've been here, a couple decades. And then in my studio, I take what I've done at the creek and turn it into maybe larger paintings that would be very challenging to do if you were on site. But the motion, it refers to, it's really, if you want to say that, it's like the subject of what I'm painting, because it's water rushing down a steep incline over beautiful and ancient rocks. And there's sound and there's movement, and it's never the same. You know, if I go at 3 p.m. today and then I go at 3 p.m. tomorrow, it's going to be a whole different, the light will be different, the way the water is moving will be different. And so it's pretty exciting to have that as an inspiration for my work. There was a point in my life when I was a strictly realist painter, where I painted what I saw and described it in a way that you can when you're good at draftsmanship and drawing and painting. But what interests me now more is taking something that I see and simplifying it down to its simplest form so that it's still pretty much recognizable. You can see, oh, that's a branch, oh, that's a rock. But it is very simple and elemental. And so that's been a process that has taken decades for me to arrive at this point.
Is that a reflection of your own spiritual growth, or is it strictly artistic process that we're talking about here?
Well, that's part of my, you know, what I'm going to talk about in my talk next week, is that I've come to a point where I don't really separate spiritual from artistic, from scientific, from, to me, it's all interrelated. You can't really, if you think about it, separate. I mean, when I make coffee for Michaela, my wife, in the morning, which for me is almost like a sacred process. I grind my own beans. I roast the beans. I grind the beans. That is a process, and it's as much of an artistic process as it is a very practical one. I mean, you're making a beverage and you can drink, but what beans do you use? How long do you roast them? How fine do you grind them? All these things, for me, are part of this process, and I consider everything is a process, if you think about it. Getting dressed in the morning is a process, and most of us have, you know, a set way of doing things, but in art, the beauty of it is that there is no set way. I mean, if you're so set in your ways when you're making a painting or drawing, then for me, it's not really that interesting. It's got to be there's got to be something unpredictable and fresh that happens every time. And a lot of artists, you know, not naming any names, have settled into one way of doing things. There's nothing really wrong with that, but to me, it's not that interesting. I like seeing a development, a process. And, you know, within that, your personality, your personal way of making marks on a surface will come forth. I mean, when you sign your name, unless it's a really good forger, nobody else can do it that way. And that's what painting is like. Nobody else can make the marks that you make And that's pretty interesting if you think about it, because it starts when you're when you can first pick up a pencil or a pen or a crayon. You know, for me, the marks of a 3, 4, 5-year-old are sometimes more compelling than going into an art gallery, because they have that innocence. And the same is true for indigenous people, the Aborigines in Australia. You know, thousands of years ago, they made paintings of the animals that they would hunt, and they were on the walls of caves, and they created their pigments from, you know, stones and rocks and dirt. And those are, as far as I'm concerned, just as masterful, sometimes more so, than the famous, you know, Renaissance paintings that we admire so much.
Is it a matter of the quality of attention that you bring to your process that determines how it comes out?
I do feel, yeah, that's a good observation, absolutely. I think, you know, I'm a meditator. I've been meditating since the 70s, and I just meditate every day, once a day. And I think that that process has allowed me to be more present when I'm painting.
I don't know
if that answers your question, but
I think it does. You know, for instance, you know, if you're not paying too much attention to a rushing creek, you might tend to fill a canvas with lots of details. And yet when I'm looking at your canvases at the launch pad, I'm struck by not so much what's there, but what's not there. Sort of in the same sense as some of those great Japanese paintings or Chinese paintings, landscape paintings. Is that a fair assessment?
Luke, you'll get your check in the mail. I'm just kidding. That is a really great observation. I mean, it makes my day, it makes my week, because that's my intention, is that for people to realize, you know, there's a lot of space here. There's more. And I am a big admirer of the great Chinese and Japanese artists, particularly 18th century, and I've studied them extensively. One in particular named Taiga, T-A-I-G-A, if you look him up, you'll see that he was famous in his day for painting things differently than they had been painted over the years traditionally. So just like a tree trunk, if you look at his tree trunks, he does it in his own special way, and he leaves a lot of space in the painting, which is pretty Japanese and Asian anyway. But I study him for that reason. He really understands space. And I had a kind of an important turning point experience some years ago when we went to an exhibition. I think it was in 2000, so actually it's 20 years ago. We went to an exhibition in New York of 19th century European plein air painters, landscape painters. And when I looked at their work, I was struck by the fact that many of the paintings were what many people would call unfinished. In other words, they had left areas of the painting, sometimes half the painting, without painting on it. And so I studied up on those guys, and I learned that their philosophy was, and this is a select group of painters who were not just French, Italian, you know, Southern European painters. They thought, well, if we go out and paint plein air, and once again, that's the French term for just outdoor painting. If we go out and paint plein air, and we get all our materials out there and we start painting, and then if we try to go back the next day to finish it, if it's unfinished, it's going to be a whole different, like I said about the creek, it's going to be a different light, the wind will be blowing differently. So they had a kind of an agreement, an unwritten agreement amongst them, where whatever you could do in one city, that was it.
Huh.
And if you look at those paintings, you'll see that that so-called unfinished part is fine. You don't question it and say, hey, what about the foreground? What happened to the grass in the foreground?
Hmm.
So that discovery, as I was preparing an exhibition, I lived for 15 years in Greece, and I exhibited there, and I still do. And so I was preparing an exhibition of paintings of the Greek landscape that I had, I had made sketches of when I was actually there in person. And I was working on one of them that was a like a peninsula of land going out into the sea on an island called Andros in the Cycladic group of islands. And I painted that peninsula with the houses, and it wasn't great detail, but it was clear that what I was painting. And then I got to the middle ground, which was the sea, and I used to paint that way. I had a ground, so-called ground. In other words, the entire canvas was painted a kind of a tannish color, so it didn't look stark white. And I looked at it when I got to that point of I was ready to start painting the sea, and something in me said, just leave it. And I thought, well, yeah, but, I mean, I get that this is okay and that this is a finished painting, but what will they say when I exhibit it? So, a few months went by. I went to Greece. I had the exhibition. And at the opening, the very first painting to sell was that one.
Huh. Interesting.
So not only did people, get it, but they really, really liked it. They liked that there was something for them to do. they had to fill in the blank, so to speak. But it worked. It worked in terms of just a painting. I mean, it doesn't look unfinished. It looks like a complete finished painting.
That unfinished quality holds for the paintings that you call gaze, various numbers gaze. Maybe not as much as the motion, creek paintings. But that unfinished quality is there, too, when you're painting portraits, apparently, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't always, but it started happening quite a few years ago, when I was... When I was in nursery school, going back a few years, in Brooklyn, I was born in Brooklyn. I spent the first 5 years of my life in Brooklyn. I went to nursery school in Brooklyn, and my teacher made a comment, which my dad kept the notes that she wrote about me, and she says, Philip is loves to draw and paint. And he's very interested in construction workers. Now, that's something unusual to say about a five-year-old.
I don't know. Every five-year-old has a dump truck, don't they?
I guess, but this
maybe not in Brooklyn.
the workers, And so fast forward, 25 years. And there I was in Greece doing a whole series. That was like the heart of the body of work I created there, were these construction workers who were building something across from my studio in Athens. And I worked up the courage to invite one of them to come and pose for a drawing. And then the rest is history. I mean, they came one by one. I drew them. I painted them for years. And... So my nursery school teacher caught that.
My first wife was an artist. She went to art school, and then she too spent time in Greece. She didn't spend 15 years there like you did, apparently, but something about Greece impacted her on a really deep level. Did the same thing happen for you?
The minute I stepped off the boat, I mean, you know, it's kind of like a fairy tale. If you go to the drop-down menu on my website called Story, my website is just my name, philiptarlow.com, and there's a drop-down menu called Story, and if you go and scroll down, you'll see that I was just hitchhiking through Europe. And my final destination was Greece because I had read a lot of Greek mythology as a kid, and I wanted to see the actual place. So I was on a boat from Yugoslavia to Greece. And getting off the boat, that's a whole other story. I met the great British sculptor Henry Moore. And anyway, as soon as I set foot on the Greek island of Corfu, I felt like I was home. And it feels that way every time I go over there. I mean, it's just amazing. And I speak fluently. The Greeks can't believe that I'm not, you know, that I wasn't raised speaking the language because I have no accent whatsoever. And yeah, so the answer is a resounding yes. It had a huge impact on me visually. Emotionally, I was kind of searching for, I knew that there were places in the world that still held the family in high esteem, and I found it. I mean, that's what Greece is all about, family. But the landscape is mind-blowing. I mean, it's just, there's no place else in the world that has that landscape. And the light, see, it's all water. The Aegean is everywhere. Huh. And so that light is always reflecting off of things. It's not like landlocked places at all.
Huh. Pretty deep light, isn't it? I mean, it's stark, no?
It's stark. At the same time, it's very warm and very, it's indescribable. It's not like any other light I've seen in any other place. I mean, maybe the Netherlands a bit, because they have a lot of water too. But anyway, yeah, it's a warm, gorgeous light that everything it falls on is, you know, just magically transformed. So I met and fell in love with a Greek woman who was my first wife, and my son, who is a theater producer and director, lives over there. He's lived there his whole life. And my grandkids are over there.
So you go back probably fairly often.
Well, we used to go a couple times a year, but now with the virus, you know, we can't really go.
Right, right. Philip, you place a very high regard for, you have a very high regard for process in your painting. Somewhere on your website, you say the process is the final product. Talk about that. And I guess that's the major subject of your artist talk next week, too, right?
It is, indeed, yeah. Because I feel like, you know, we're all geared towards what's the final product? What's the painting look like? What's the final product? What's the pasta dinner look like or taste like? But, you know, if you think about it, it's a process to get there. So I feel like the process is the subject of the painting. What I do, like today, I'm working on a new painting, and unexpected things happened that influenced the progress of the painting in a good way. And those are all visible. I mean, if I were to take you and stand in front of that painting, I could show you all the unexpected, sometimes things that almost in the moment seem like mistakes. But really, It's a process. I mean, there are good paintings and bad paintings and one everything in between. But I feel like I like to have that visibility in the final painting. So the one I described that I did for that exhibition of the Greek island, that, you know, you can see, it's much easier in a sense to see the process in a painting like that, because you can see where it trailed off and I just stopped describing the landscape or painting the landscape. And so I learned to trust the process. You know, there's a gut feeling you have. And I like to use that metaphor of cooking, because, you know, when you're a good cook, really good cook, you know, you have to taste it. You know, okay, take it off the fire right now, or it'll be too late. Well, that's the same with painting or drawing. You know, if you're in the groove, which you're not always, but hopefully a lot of the time you are, or I am, your gut tells you, you know, where to go next, where the brush should go, where the pencil should go, whatever the tool is that you're using. And that process is, you know, the extreme opposite, I would say, of what I'm talking about, painting as a transparent process, that's the word I was looking for, would be somebody like the painter Durer. You know him, he was famous for doing really precise drawings. They're beautiful, and paintings, mostly portraits he did. But, you know, the process is totally obscured. I mean, it's the exact opposite of what I'm talking about. You can't really see how that painting happened. You can just see this perfect final result, which, like I say, is very beautiful, is very artistically brilliant. But it's just not my style. I value the process, just like in this radio talk that we're doing. You know, I mean, I didn't sit down and plot out, okay, here's what I'm going to say if he asks me this, here's what I'm going to say if he asks me that. You know, I think that spontaneity, that in-the-moment quality is what I strive for in art and in life. I'm going to talk about the process as sort of compare it or contrast it with what many Western people are geared to think about as, okay, what's the final product? What's it? You know, forget about, I don't care about process. I want to know what's the final product. And, you know, today may have been the final day of painting on this. I won't know until I go look at it in the morning, but it's a process. It's like at a certain point your gut says, okay, just like with that painting where I didn't do the foreground and it sold immediately, my gut said, that's it, you're done. And the same with drawings. I mean, I make a lot of drawings, and many of them are of people, because we travel to Carbondale, we travel to Edwards, we go places where there are schools that we're working with, because Michaela is designing a really interesting educational product for the middle and high schools that is based on experiential learning. And so before the virus, we used to go to at least 2-3 times a month, we would go to these places just because she would be talking to the teachers and the kids and introducing the product, et cetera. And a lot of the time I was sitting in the coffee shop what's the name of that coffee shop in Carbondale?
It's escaping me too.
Yeah, and I would be sitting there for hours.
Huh.
Or there's another one like it in Edwards, but it's much bigger, and I would just be drawing people. And I also love drawing people in Arthur's waiting rooms because they're just sitting there waiting, you know, and perfect subjects. But my point is that when I do those drawings, sometimes, you know, I mean, if you look at a really good, well, they're all good, but if you look at a Matisse drawing or a Picasso drawing, you'll see that they could do one line that delineates the face, the hat, and the shoulder, and the arm in one line.
Huh.
Now, that's not something you can plan out. It comes because you're thinking about what you're looking at, and you just your hand and your arm just go there. So it's that process that interests me, is like you have your signature marks. Have to study up to do your signature. You just have that. And I have a good friend, you may have heard of him. His name is David Hockney, and he's a world-renowned artist who lives in California and, you know, has paintings in every museum in the world. And he likes to talk about mark-making. So that would include painting, drawing, anything that makes marks on the surface. And so that is all about process. It's all about, it's a journey. You know, when you do your signature, your pen starts here, and without thinking, all of a sudden, it's over there. But when you're drawing a face or whatever, a tree, if you're in the groove, if you're in that sweet spot, it just happens, and all of a sudden you might do, like Picasso and Matisse did, one delineates the tree, few leaves, the stream in the background, you know, it just happens. And that's, to me, extremely exciting and wonderful, you know, that being in that process, and you understand that way children's art a lot better. And you understand indigenous art a lot better, because that's the place they most of the time. You know, 3 or 4 year old doesn't think he's doing an artistic thing. He's just making marks and fooling around.
So does the fidelity to your process determine some of the more mundane choices, like palette or size, or whether you bring in collage elements, or all of those things? Is that all part of the process too?
It is. It's very unpredictable. There was a period of time in like 2014, 2015, when I was really into collage and taking, I have a huge box with scraps of newspaper and scraps of maps and all kinds of paper. I don't know if I could do that right now today. I'm not in that place. So the current painting I'm working on, it's interesting, you know, I've been doing all these watercolors because I hurt my shoulder. And I have pain in my shoulder. And I hurt it, you know, with repetitive movements that I do when I'm doing a large painting. And so the doctor said, well, you know, just focus on small stuff for a while and don't do those big sweeping movements. So I start doing watercolors, and I've done 112, 112 watercolors, just because, I mean, that's all I could do. It didn't hurt my shoulder.
And several of those watercolors are in the show, right?
They are in the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I learned a tremendous amount doing them. I don't know if I'm answering your question about process, but I learned, you know, when you do, the main thing about a watercolor is that you can't erase what you've done. You can't paint over what you've done like you can with oil. You got one shot, and if it's not good, then you just start another one. Mm-hmm. So I learned, you know, a lot by doing 112 watercolors in a row about just how I already knew this, but I learned it even more deeply, just how important each stroke is, how much paint is on the brush. And so, you know, you're in a certain mood when you're working in that way. And so I got really antsy to start doing oil painting. And just 2 days ago, I said, what the hell, I'm gonna do an oil painting. Let's see so that I don't have to stretch a canvas, which would be hard on my shoulder. I've got some that are already stretched. Let's see what I've got. And I found one that was long and narrow because I did a whole series of paintings that were long and narrow, meaning 78 inches high and 26 inches wide. So it was, you know, it was a no-brainer. I mean, I didn't have to do any big physical work. Plus, because I'm no longer working in the way that I did when I did that motion series where you'll see there's layers and layers of paint. I wasn't satisfied. I scraped it over. I painted over it. I scraped it again. And so this is more in the vein of a watercolor because that's what I've been doing so long. So it was really interesting. Come back to oil with the mindset of a watercolorist. And so it's, once again, a big aha moment, a big discovery. Oh, my God, I painted in oil for years and years, but I never painted in oil as if it was watercolor. You know, just very light strokes and not all these layers of paint and stuff. So, you know, could I have done that if I didn't go through this process of having to restrain my movements? I don't think so. But it's all, you know, when you step back and look at it, it looks like somebody wrote this script. Like, okay, Philip, you're going to hurt your shoulder, then you're going to have to do all these small watercolors, and you're going to learn about not being able to paint over or erase or scrape like you've been doing. And then you're going to go back to oil, and it'll be a whole different experience. Well, That was the script. That's what I'm doing.
Well, to my untrained eye, those paintings have the quality of watercolors. It's almost like there are numerous layers of washes of color in the background. I don't know how you achieve that, but it strikes me that that's sort of the process of watercolor, too. Same thing.
Yes and no. I mean, the big difference is that those motion paintings are very thick layers of paint, even though it doesn't look that way.
Oh, really?
If you were to do like an X-ray of them, you would see each one has about three or four different but similar paintings underneath.
Okay. Huh. That's interesting. That's really interesting.
When I didn't like it, I just scraped over it, painted, you know, a thin layer. That's why you see what underneath, and it looks like a watercolor, because I didn't completely obliterate the painting underneath. I just painted over it with a wash of oil paint, so that you could see sort of a ghost image underneath.
Yeah,
which I like. I like that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why they do look like watercolor. That's a good observation.
Where do you see your paintings going in the future, Philip Darlow? Where's the process taking you? Is it taking you to the top of the peak, or is it taking you somewhere else?
I think, you know, like I said in the beginning of our talk, I think I'm headed in the direction of greater and greater simplicity, taking away more and more of what is not really essential. And I think that that's my process, is more space, more less descriptiveness and more what's the energy of this, it's great to be able, right now I'm using the creek as my inspiration. I mean, it's just a great inspiration. It's always there. It's always changing. It's always beautiful. But what I do with it is a whole different story. So what I did today, I like to think is not an improvement, because I don't think there is improvement in art. There's just, you know, the process and change. But I think it's a step in the direction of less is more.
Fascinating, really fascinating stuff. Philip, I want to thank you for joining us today and talking a little bit about your art. Really interesting stuff.
Well, I want to thank you, because your observations and questions were, like I said, you know, just made my day. I mean, that's why I want to give this talk, is that a lot of people, you know, don't quite get the kinds of things that you observed and you talked about. And I want to be able to transmit that in a way that they will look at art differently and have a deeper, more rewarding experience.
Well, mission accomplished. Good job, sir.
I can't wait to meet you. I'm sure I'll meet you. And we'll sit down and have a beer or something. I really enjoy
that. Sounds good. That sounds good. Let's do it.
Okay.
All right. Take care.
Thank you so much, Luke. And stay safe.
All right. You too. Bye-bye.